Good morning. I'm delighted to welcome all of you, but especially the students from Waupun High School. Would they stand, please? Good having you with us. You may be seated. These students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. It's a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from the high schools across the state are invited to come for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they're sent briefs in the case that we are about to hear. And they may engage in activities around that case. And then the last aspect of the day in the court is to have a presentation by and meet with a justice of this court. And you are welcome. For everyone else here, if you would wish a copy of the summary of this case, if you'd raise your hand, we'll give you one. Marshall will do that. It is easy to understand the argument if you're familiar with the facts and the legal issues. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom the students will meet after lunch. I say students, but it is an open session and anyone may participate. You're all welcome. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues of the case, but on the procedures of the court. Seated next to Justice Butler is no one today. It's an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice David Prosser sits there. He will not be participating in this case. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack, and on the far left, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 2068P1379-CR, State versus MacArthur. Representing Mr. MacArthur is Alex Flynn. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alex Flynn. I'm a lawyer from Milwaukee. And together with Marjorie McGuire, we represent the defendant, Bruce MacArthur, in this cause of action. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here today discussing this case with you. There are three issues for the court to address. The first is, should we have one clear, readily interpreted statute of limitations for offenses dealing with criminal sexual misconduct with children? Second, if not, what burden of proof must the state carry in ascertaining compliance with the statute of limitations, and to who should that burden be argued, the judge, the jury, or both? The third issue is whether due process considerations prevent the state from prosecuting an 86-year-old man for an offense that occurred 35 to 40 years ago. Now, to understand the first issues, that is, the statute of limitations, I think it's important to lay out the progression of the child sexual assault statutes going back to the 60s. Bruce MacArthur is 86 years old and is charged for sexual misconduct between 1966 and 1972. Back then, that conduct was criminalized under Statute 944, Sections 10 and 11. That's what he's charged with now. In 1975, the legislature continued to criminalize that conduct and renumbered that conduct as violative of Chapter 940.225 of the Wisconsin statutes. In 1987, the legislature continued to criminalize that same misconduct and denominated the statute criminalizing it Section 948.02. And what I'm going to get to later, and I think the reason we're here today, is that at the same time in 1987, effective 1989, the legislature created a new statute of limitations intending to punish and get offenders of this misconduct and expanded the statute of limitations from the traditional 6 years to which we had all been accustomed, subject to public resident tolling, and expanded it to say, and here's where I think we're here, to say it may be brought within 6 years or by the time the victim reaches the age of 21, whichever is later. But then in 1993, the legislator expressly rejected that equivocation and said, no, it shall be brought, and expanded it to age 26. A cause of action, a criminal cause of action for criminal misconduct with children shall be brought by the time the victim is age 26 or be barred. If there's one thing I want to leave here today is have those words ringing here, or be barred, in section 939.742C.
Counselor, did the conduct that occurred here, 6667, doesn't it fall outside of the statute you're talking about because they can only be applied to conduct that occurred at a later period of time?
Yes, no, and I think that's where the confusion comes from. What they said in 1987, probably in concerns for ex post facto consideration, said this statute of limitation is going to be prospective only. It's only going to apply after 1989 because we don't want any problems with conduct earlier. But then in 1993, they said, no, we are taking that back. We are remitting that. And we're saying it shall be brought by the time they're age 26. Then, of course, this court's decision in State versus Haynes sanctioned that and said, yes, I think the word was, it was wonderful, while the hunt is still on, the parameters can be expanded. While an existing statute of limitations is still alive and well, you can amend it to create a longer one. And that's what they did in 1993.
That's a different concern than I have. I have a concern with the words of the statute itself when it was amended that said it doesn't apply to conduct that occurred during this period of time, not what the statute of limitations may or may not have been. And so if it doesn't apply to this conduct that occurred way back in 66 or 67, then you don't get to the application of the statutes and any of the later statutes of limitations. That's kind of what's bothering me. Can you address that?
Yes, it didn't apply during that hybrid period. Because
which period are we exactly talking about?
I beg your pardon?
Which period?
1987, effective 1989 to 1993.
Okay.
In 1989, the law of the land was it shall be prospective only, and it may be brought within 6 years or age 21,
right,
whichever is later. But then in 1993, they did away with that, and they said it shall be brought by the time the victim is age 26 or be barred.
But it doesn't say anything about the conduct, the timing of the conduct in that change. It changes may to shall, but it doesn't say this statute now applies to conduct regardless of when the conduct occurred. That's what's troubling me. Am I making any sense?
No, I guess I don't. The initial application, it was for that amended statute of limitations or that newly created statute of limitations expanding the time limit to age 21 was for offenses that were going to be charged after 1989, not for anything before.
Right.
And so that they abolished in 1993 when they said, no, that's not enough. We want to go back for the victim if they're 26, if they're 31 in 1997, if they're 45 in 2003, unless I'm not understanding the question.
Yeah, we're not communicating, and I'll look at my notes a little more and see if I can phrase a better question to you, because we're talking past each other.
Counsel, I think you're saying that the date of the charging is what controls, and perhaps what Justice Rogensack is concerned about is alleged date of offense, which controls.
If the conduct not yet charged, it would be when the date was charged. It would be the date that it was charged, from 1987 to 1993. That's what that's...
Correct, but, you know, he was not charged under that statute. He was charged under the old 944.10 and 944.11, 66.67.
Right, but if the state is correct that the public residency tolling stopped that statute from running, it was not an action yet, it was not yet barred. And 939.74.2C applied to actions not yet barred. That was still a viable cause of action in 1993 when they amended it and made it age 26 and so on. It was still a viable cause of action, so under State versus Haynes, it could be amended and could be made to apply retroactively. I think the confusion does arise in this hybrid period from 87 to 93, and I think it was created, and then it was abolished in 1993. And then they reached back, and if you look at the intent of what they were trying to do, make it easier, make it more to prosecute child sex offenders. And they did it in a very clear fashion, saying we're going to focus on the age of the victim. We're not going to worry about public residency tolling. We're not going to worry about those kind of things. We will come in and look at the age of the victim. And after 1993, it's age 26. And after 1997, it was age 31. And after 2003, it was age 45. And after 2006, now it's life for some offenses. And I think the confusion comes back is, I think we have to ignore that five-year period from 1987 to 1993, because the logical conclusion for that would be 948.02, and that's the next problem here in the case. When we look at 93974 sub 2C, it says offenses under 948. But 948 really is 940.225, its immediate predecessor statute, which really is Chapter 944, the immediate predecessor of that. Because to say otherwise, you could have a whole boatload of offenders as late as the late 1980s with 3-year-old, 4-year-old victims out there who by the time 1995 rolled around would be 11 years old, couldn't be prosecuted. So it's got to reach back. We have to look at 1987 as somewhat of an anomaly, that 5-year period. And then go to 1993 and say that is the statute. And they've been clear and decisive and since then.
Explain to me, if you will, this anomaly. You just said you'd have a 3-year-old that by age 11. Explain that. Give more meat
if you will. I've written down. I didn't want to go over the court with a bunch of. I've got a whole bunch of hypotheticals. There could be a There could be a 3-year-old that was assaulted in 1989. And if we adopt this strict reading of the 1987 statute, once 6 years expired and that 3-year-old is now 9, they could not be prosecuted because the statute of limitations would have expired. But I think the legislature recognized that problem in 1993, expanded these statutes, and said, no, we're going to let that girl get to be age 26.
How do you respond to this argument? Now, you are your argument is in part based on that you've set forth is over the years this statute has constructively survived into the new statute. That's the language you use. And your argument thus far is that building on and showing how the initial statute has survived through the various amendments. Why not just look at the current statute, say plain reading, and it doesn't pertain to the charge because the charge is under a different statute, different number, plain reading of the statute is that it only pertains to whatever the number is. It's the argument in part that the state needs. What's wrong with that?
Two reasons. One, there is precedent in this state, and we cited it later in the briefing, State versus Farm and the Irish case, where the Court of Appeals, under a 980 analysis, the state tried to use a 944 conviction on the old statute's 944. The defendant in that case said, no, exactly what you're saying here. Chapter 980 refers to offenses under 948.02. The Court of Appeals said, no, don't look at the number. Look at the conduct. The continuing conduct, and that's what must be punished, that's what must be regulated. So we have court precedent that under the 980 analysis, and if it applies there, it applies for a statute of limitations as well. But more importantly, if we do that, these statutes with the legislature attempting to go back to the 70s and the 80s to get more younger, viable offenders, a 20-year-old offender in 1989, if we take that reading by 1995, if they've lived here, that statute's expired, and that victim might only be 10 or 11 years old. And we're defeating the very will of the legislature of trying to get these offenders and protect society. And so to rule otherwise, to reach way back, and I think the legislature contemplated there might be an enfeebled 86 or 87-year-old from 1966 that might not be able to be prosecuted. But better that than potentially disable a boatload of younger offenders in the late 80s. And what I'm suggesting is a very clear, simple rule of statutory analysis. And it's not that far a stretch. And one court of appeals, I found later in this briefing process, agreed with me that you read 948.02 as prohibiting conduct. It's got to include 940.225, which was in effect up until 1989. And if it includes 940.225, it's got to include 944, because it's the same conduct all the way through. And there's no logical reason for not. No, I think, and this would be a clear rule, we'll come in, we'll go back as far as we can, and we'll, under a Haynes analysis, we'll see if a victim has changed at some point, and so that a constitutional right is vested in some earlier expired statute. But it's a very clear, simple rule. It's going to be clarified. It'll put the public on notice clearly. Now it's life, and before that it was age 45. And it might be that going back to 1966, an 87-year-old man might not be able to be prosecuted. So I think the court should adopt this rule that we're suggesting today. The court should say what the statute says, and the court should give teeth to the legislative clear intent repeatedly year after year after year, it shall be brought by a certain age or be barred as a statute of repose that might otherwise quash or extinguish an otherwise viable cause of action. The next, should the court reject that, we're going to, I want to discuss the next procedure. What do we do if we let this?
Let me just summarize this if I can so I understand it. Your position is that the statute of limitation at the time the crime was charged applies? The statute of limitation at the time of the, or 1993-94 version?
The 1993-94 version.
That's what you think. Okay.
Yeah. Under Haynes analysis, it was still a viable one. It was still going on. And I would also say this. In the trial court in earlier proceedings, I had been concentrating on the age 45 time limit in 2006. The same analysis happens. Actually, the alleged victims in this case were all 26 in 1993 anyway, so the same analysis applies then. I was just focusing on the immediate age of them in 2006.
Okay.
Now, what do we do in the event? And let me just very, very briefly summarize this. In the state's arguments, they don't discuss farm. They discuss something about elements being different, but they're really not. It's the exact same conduct, and the subsequent statutes, 940 and 948, merely described in more detail.
Well, there are elements that were present in the old statute under which he was charged. You had to know the person was not your wife. We don't have that in our current statute, do we?
Yeah, I think it's easier to get a conviction under the earlier one than the later ones. It's easier to do it.
Just talking about whether the elements were different, and I think that's the state's position. Whether it's easier or not kind of depends on the proof that you end up with.
Right. Well, the earlier statutes are private parts. The later statutes are anus, buttock, breast, and whatever. It went on to describe indecent liberties, frankly, I think is a little broader. It would be a little more difficult to defend than intentional sexual conduct and everything else. And I don't think, yes, there's a difference, and I think but it's not substantial and it's not meaningful, and I think the legislative intent was to incorporate that conduct into it. I absolutely do. And I don't think that, I don't know that this court should differentiate 940 from 944. I think it'll contribute to a degree of cynicism in the courts, and I think it's not. I don't think it's the appropriate way to go. I think it's the conduct is the conduct is the conduct, as the Farm case said. As the Farm case said. Now, in addition, Your Honors, I want to discuss briefly the due process in the event this court rejects my argument here today. I still think it is a due process problem with prosecuting an enfeebled 87-year-old man for offenses 35 to 40 years ago.
Isn't that an argument that's better made at sentencing than here?
It is. It could be, but the prosecution itself is also very difficult.
Well, isn't that in the discretion of the prosecutor?
It could be a discretionary call by a prosecutor whether or not to bring a case, but at some point there has to be a rule and there has to be some analysis regulating that discretion of how the prosecutor thinks and what goes into the input and what goes into the decision as to why the case is brought to begin with. And at some point, I don't know that I can argue public policy about the cost of criminal prosecutions and the decision-making. I don't want to criticize the decision-making on it, but frankly, it's 86 years old. These offenses occurred in 1966, and I think we have not shown any tactical delay or intentional delay. We're not alleging that in bringing these charges. I don't think there was any. But I think at some point, as the amicus brief pointed out here in State versus Wilson, that shouldn't be the only reason for a due process violation. There can be other violations. I think sometimes the facts and the timing on their face speak. That is, 87 years old for charges in 1966 is simply too long.
Mr. Flynn, let me interrupt if I might. It seems to me that your argument about the age of the defendant would carry a lot more weight in terms of due process if the claim was that in some way his age prevented him from presenting an adequate defense. In other words, that he either was somewhat incompetent or suffering from Alzheimer's or something like that, or had lost any memory of these incidents that are alleged. Is there anything like that pending here?
Well, there's nothing like that pending here. There are certainly issues that could arise, but the larger question to me is, why are we doing it to begin with? Why do we want to bring in, if as the state alleges, this person's been out of the state for 35 to 40 years, why do we want to saddle the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin with the prosecution, frankly, potentially the geriatric care, of an 87-year-old, and potentially the expensive referrals for competency proceedings and everything else? Why do we want to do that?
You're not then arguing that there was any prejudice, which is another way of stating Justice Crooks's question.
Correct.
You're not arguing that he's prejudiced in any matter by the long delay in bringing this charges, namely, can't remember, he doesn't have the records, physically, mentally ill, any other prejudice. You're not arguing that.
I'm not arguing that. I don't think there's facts on the record to support it, but I think the court can presume it. I think the court can presume that when I'm sitting next to him at trial, I'm going to be dealing with someone who's going to be forgetful and infirmed by age. I think there's nothing in the record here. I'm not going to create facts here, but I think it can be I think it can be presumed.
I don't know that you should presume anything about age, either young, middle, or old. you're on very sensitive grounds.
I withdraw that. Let me move on, please.
Is there another due process argument you have?
Let's move on. I want to go into the mechanics of the logistics of what we're going to do with the statute of limitations. Should this court reject the original statute of limitations argument that I'm making and adopt this procedure? Apparently, it is a first impression in the state how we go about proving this, how we go about proving whether the state has complied with the statute of limitations. I'm suggesting, I think, a very real-world, day-in and day-out, common-sense remedy to this, and I would ask the court reject the confusing federal system that the state is suggesting it adopt as unnecessary. I'm suggesting that when I think it's important to keep in mind, the statute of limitations case issues usually hit people between the eyes at the beginning of the case. It's usually not something that, halfway through you realize, hey, the statute might have been blown, or he was in public. It usually hits people between the eyes, kind of like a venue case. Oh, it said this happened in Ozaukee County, and we're in Milwaukee. You usually bring that up right away at the beginning. And at that point, I think we should defer to the broad discretion of the trial court under 90104 at the outset. I think it should be a two-step process. The motion is brought, and the trial court makes a preliminary review under 90104, and I can envision that preliminary review being as short as a five-minute offer of proof up to a two-day evidentiary hearing, if it wants to. And at the conclusion of that hearing, the issue for the trial court will be to determine whether the state has sufficient evidence to bring to a jury, to prove to a jury that it has complied with the statute of limitations beyond any reasonable doubt. Once that process is done, and that's going to be a huge gatekeeping, that's going to head off a lot of potential problems.
Now, what's the issue? Public residents, that is residents in Wisconsin, in this case?
That's an excellent point. There are two issues that will come. In this case, we have a legal one and a factual one. A lot of times it might only be a legal one.
Okay, what are they
here? Sometimes it'll be a factual one. In this one, it's a legal one, 93974-2C. What does it mean? How does it fire? Does it apply? But there's also a factual one here. Tolling. State alleges he's been out of the state since 1970, although I think I read in there one of the offenses alleged to have occurred in 1972. So there's clearly a factual issue here. They say he's been out of the state, what is that, 38 years? 38 years. And so there's a tremendous factual issue as to whether or not they have complied with the statute of limitations. So as to those factual issues, the legal issues, I think the courts can head off and take care of. They can make those decisions as a matter of law.
Counsel, excuse me, I'm not understanding what you mean by the factual issue. Can you be more specific?
Was he a resident of the state of Wisconsin? Has the state complied with the statute of limitations?
Just factually, where was he living after the offenses?
Correct.
Gotcha.
After the offense, so that whether or not whether the case can be brought to begin with.
Okay.
Well, that's both factual and legal. He comes into Wisconsin periodically, let us say. That's a question, does that constitute residence under the legal definition, or is it just not residence? I mean, residence is always a factual and legal issue. What are the facts, and do they constitute the legal standard? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, but I believe that it should be the jury that determines the facts. I think they're better equipped for it. I think we have precedent, ample precedent in this state with venue determinations. There's a committee jury instruction on venue determinations. There are territorial jurisdiction. This court's...
What do you want the trial court to decide?
I want the trial court to decide at the outset under 90104, a preliminary matter, whether the state has sufficient evidence to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that it has complied with the statute of limitations. Not two determinations beyond a reasonable doubt, just simply whether the state has sufficient evidence to carry the thing forward. And it might pique a trial court's interest. I could see a trial court saying, I think we should have a day-long hearing on this.
Does it matter about whether the state's what the state's burden of proof at trial is?
At that level, I think the state should be, the burden should be the state has to.
That's a heavy amount of evidence if they have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt at the trial.
I think they have to. My suggestion would be that they show to that judge that they have sufficient proof to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, I can see if there is no evidence, then a court might say, as a matter of law, there is no evidence on this issue. But when it goes beyond the no evidence, why should there be a preliminary finding on the issue of statute of limitations beyond a reasonable doubt when all you need for the elements of the offense to go to the jury is a determination of probable cause?
Because it goes to jurisdiction, you're asking someone to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the court, because we have ample precedent in the state with territorial jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction and venue for discussing preliminary matters like that with a trial court. Now I'll concede venue is more of a constitutional nature than statute of limitations. Because I don't know that it would be that great of an extra effort for the judge to make it. And I think there should be a finding by that trial judge reviewing the evidence. And it may very well be what you're suggesting. And I don't know that we want to call it a probable cause standard. I'm reluctant to concede that. But I think the state has to bring forward evidence. Let me give you an example in this case. We have an alleged deposition taken in South Dakota. 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. There's going to be issues of authentication of that transcript. There's going to be apparently yellowed business records from various districts or dioceses where Mr. MacArthur was. I think those are issues the judge has to look at, and I think that might be a more prolonged hearing at the outset of the case. But then I think it's a significant enough issue that once it gets to that point, we should be able to have a verdict question potentially, like they have in venue cases. I'm not making any of this up. We already have the structure in place. We have it in venue cases. When it's sufficiently there, if you find the defendant guilty, answer this question. Has the state proven to you beyond any reasonable doubt that he's been in this state or out of the state, contrary to the statute of limitations, and would go back to the beginning of the cause of action, the filing of the complaint, the warrant being issued, whenever the commencement of the criminal case began.
Counselor, just so I understand you, your position is that the defendant has no burden at all. He doesn't have a burden of production before the circuit court, and obviously he doesn't have any burden when it gets to the jury.
Yes, yes, it is. And I think, because in the real world, frequently you're dealing with drug-addled, mentally ill, infirm people, and to just come out and say they're better equipped to know where they've been is not necessarily always the case in the real world when you're dealing with these real defendants. And I think, unlike the speedy trial analysis, that's more of a balancing act. That's not a good analogy. That's not for the court to draw, because that is more of a balancing. I think the cases the state cited, the Whitman case where the fellow was in the Army, the Scher case where he's going back and forth to Florida, and the Slaughter case where he's taken into federal custody, interestingly, those factual issues were just decided by the judges in those cases. But those are really an apposite to what I'm suggesting here on a tolling issue. There are real, live, vital issues of fact here that a jury is better equipped to decide than a court. And with the Mintner decision allowing for the statute of limitations defense to be raised at any time, I think that's a dust storm as well. Look, if it comes up pre-trial or trial, it can be pretty readily handled. It's discussed, there's a motion, there's a jury instruction conference, potentially another question on the verdict form, and it's handled. If it comes up post-trial, and it's hard to envision a scenario where that would happen, where after it, oops, you were out of the state all that time, or you were in the statute of limitations ran, it'd be hard to envision a scenario where that would occur, but if it does, it would be some other analysis, like ineffective assistance of counsel or something like that. It wouldn't be any great end of the world event. So I think these arguments, respectfully, the state brings are somewhat distracting and don't contribute to the analysis.
Are there any other questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I see my red light is on. I'll sit down.
There are none. Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
James Frymuth, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Frymuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as both, respondent and cross-appellant. Defendant MacArthur stands charged with 7 crimes of child sexual assault that allegedly occurred between February 7, 1966 and June 15, 1972, under then Chapter 944 of the statutes. On the issues raised by this appeal, the state respectfully asks the Court to hold as follows. First, the statute of limitations in place at the time of the charged crimes, 939.74, which was the same between 1966 and 72, governs the present case. No revision of that statute trumps the continuing application of the 1966-72 version. No subsequent revision of Section 939.74 extinguished any existing cause of action, such as a cause of action for a felony for which the standard 6-year limitations period has been tolled under the public resident tolling provision. Second, due process does not bar this prosecution. MacArthur has not shown either actual prejudice from the pre-charging delay or that the delay is attributable to the state, as opposed to simply being the product of when the complainants came forward. Third, this Court should remand the public resident tolling question to the trial court for its determination, holding the state to prove tolling by a preponderance of the evidence. If the Court allows the prosecution to proceed, the jury doesn't revisit tolling. The only possible jury issue could be a specific verdict question on the date or date range of a particular charged crime. And this only occurs if there is a factual dispute at trial that the defendant claims would implicate the statute of limitations.
Then it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
With respect to the date, correct.
With respect to what date?
With respect, If there's a dispute at trial as to when a particular charged crime occurred, and if that dispute, according to the defendant, would be cause the statute of limitations to have expired on that particular charge, then you need to ask the jury in a specific question to determine the specific date. And I would suggest you don't even necessarily or shouldn't necessarily tell the jury why they're determining that date, okay, although it may become obvious.
But you're, other than that, as to the factual question of date of charge, the jury is not involved in determining public residence.
Correct.
And you just have to prove it to the trial court by a preponderance of the evidence. Is that it?
That's correct. And the state's, with respect to the tolling issue, the critical aspect of it from the state's perspective is the burden, and that should be preponderance of the evidence, whether it's solely a trial court question, or if this court could do as it did with territorial jurisdiction, say that on undisputed facts, it's a question for the court. But if there are disputed facts, this court could say it goes to the jury, but then the standard should still be preponderance of the evidence.
So it gets a little confusing. Your opposing counsel says that it's a bit complex, and I had to, sift and think about it. So you're saying with regard to the tolling issue, it can be a preliminary question to be addressed by the court with a preponderance of evidence standard. If the tolling question is to go to the jury, was he back and forth really when he was here? How long was he here? Does that constitute residence? Blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
If that is to go to the jury, it is still a preponderance burden, you say. However, if what is going to the jury is really the date of the occurrence or the date range of the occurrence, then the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what I understand your argument to be. Am I correct with regard to that?
Yes, except that all three of those things wouldn't necessarily happen under the state's position. Under the state's position, primary position is that tolling is solely for the trial court.
What if there are genuine issues of fact?
Genuine issue of fact that would go to the jury would be on the date or date range that they'd have to find beyond a reasonable
doubt. Okay, then I misunderstood, because I thought that if there were genuine issues of fact as to when, if he was back in state, yes, he was, no, he wasn't, I came here for this period of time, no, you didn't, you were that period of time, that would go to the jury.
No, not under the state's first primary argument.
But then you have an alternative argument.
That's
and
correct.
Under your alternative argument, it goes to the jury.
That's correct.
If for a preponderance of evidence.
That's correct. I didn't mean to confuse by the alternatives, but that's, I think each one, hopefully each one is simple enough as it stands itself. The first is just solely for the trial court. State's burden preponderance. The alternative is that if you're going to say it's a jury question, it's for the jury by a preponderance. I'm sorry, on the first one, I didn't mean to confuse this. On the first one, solely for the court by a preponderance with respect to tolling. But you could have a question arise at trial as to when the crime occurred. Nothing to do with public residence.
And that's beyond the reasonable doubt. Even though there are issues of fact under your primary argument, not your alternative, even though there are factual issues that would go to the tolling question, not the date of the offense, your primary argument is the court should decide those factual issues and the burden would be preponderance of evidence.
That's correct. Turning,
that makes it simple, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, one of the advantages, or I should say one of the reasons for suggesting that this, or among the reasons for suggesting that tolling should be for the trial court, is that we're talking about a jurisdictional issue with respect to public residency. It has nothing to do with the charged crime. It doesn't affect the determination of whether the defendant committed the charged crime. It doesn't go to any of the elements. Plus, because it's a jurisdictional question, Whoever loses on that jurisdictional question, including the state, has an opportunity then for appellate review of that jurisdictional question.
Why isn't venue jurisdictional? And venue under our case law is beyond a reasonable doubt standard that goes to the jury.
Sure. Two things about venue. One, there's a constitutional provision that addresses that under both state and federal. Historically, Wisconsin has looked at venue as a jury question beyond a reasonable doubt. But a distinction in reality is that venue talks about where the charged crime occurred. Public residency tolling has nothing to do with the charged crime.
Well, that's a different question. I mean, every question is different. I can distinguish every question on, oh, that's a different question. But just because it's a different question doesn't mean that the burden should be different. Help me with that.
Well, with respect to the burden, there are several reasons why preponderance is the preferred burden from the state's perspective. One of those is that when we're talking about where the defendant lived, presumably the defendant, assuming he's otherwise of sound mind, and you know he's going to know where he lived. It's much more difficult for the state to determine necessarily where the defendant may have been during all this time. Most courts, state courts, apply a preponderance standard. Whether they say it's a jury question or not, they apply a preponderance standard. That's addressed in the brief. The federal courts, when they look at the similar flight from justice tolling provision, they look at it exclusively as a district court, trial court issue. The only thing that goes to the jury is when, you know, the date of the crime. That's in every case. Even without a statute of limitations issue, the state always has to prove that the crime occurred within the statute of limitations.
Mr. Freimuth, there's one thing that I'm not clear on. As I understand statute of limitations defenses, it's an affirmative defense. And as I understand that, at least the way I've always assumed that the burden would work with respect to an affirmative defense is you would have to determine whether or not it was going to be one that was going to raise an issue at trial that might shift then the burden to the state, which the state would have to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. But if we were talking about the mere affirmative defense standard, that it would be preponderance of the evidence, but it would be a preponderance shown by the defendant as to whether or not they met their defense. Is that what you're saying here?
No,
it sounds
no,
like you're saying
no,
it the opposite.
No, I'm not.
It sounds like you're saying
I'm not.
That the state would have a preponderance of the evidence.
I
think it's the opposite.
Well, this is one of the peculiarities and why I think we just want some clarity on this issue. In the case law, it talks about it as going to personal jurisdiction rather than an affirmative defense. Most of the cases talk about it that way, I believe. One case talks about it, and that's the Slaughter case, Court of Appeals, talks about it as an affirmative defense. But I think that case is distinguishable because it talks about it in terms of it was within the 946 crime itself that it raised the issue of it had to be brought within a certain time. I don't think this should be characterized as an affirmative defense in the traditional sense where the defendant has the burden of showing that the defense has been proven. Two states do that, but most states say with respect to statute of limitations issues, it's the state's burden, and we've accepted that burden. We just say that it should be by a preponderance.
In the civil area, at least, isn't the establishment of a statute of limitations argument, isn't that considered generally an affirmative defense in civil area?
I have to admit, I don't know.
Okay.
On page 19 and 20 of your blue brief, that is your brief in chief, on your cross petition, you indicate that some states hold that a statute of limitations issue is for the trial court to determine on undisputed facts, holding the state to proof by a preponderance of evidence that follows up what Justice Butler was saying, whether the crime occurred within the limitation period, but that if relevant facts are in dispute, the issue is for the jury with, now we get even a little more complex, with the burden to be either a preponderance of evidence or by a reasonable certainty or beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's what the other states you suggest are doing. If there's no dispute of facts on the tolling, it stays with the court. If there are disputed facts, it goes to the jury, and there's a variety of burdens.
Correct. Yes, that's correct.
So pick one.
Our position is that the federal system is the simplest and from the state's perspective, obviously the best scenario, and that is tolling on public residency tolling is exclusively for the trial court to determine with the state's burden preponderance of the evidence. At trial, as in every case, regardless of whether there's a statute of limitations question, the state has to prove that the crime occurred within the statute of limitations. Normally, that doesn't become an issue. Normally, it's referenced by saying, as alleged in the information, which refers to the date. So, that's the simple answer, and that's the state's primary position. I'm just saying I could see that with respect to, because of this variety, and because the court has done this with respect to territorial, you could say that when there's undisputed facts, it's for the trial court. But if tolling has disputed facts, it goes to the jury. And like I say, our primary concern is that the burden be preponderance in that situation, not beyond a reasonable doubt. With respect, if I may then turn to the first question of which statute of limitations controls in this case, the state's position is that the statute at the time of the charged crimes is the controlling statute, and that has never been extinguished, done away with. That's the controlling statute of limitations. In fact, that is the case law says that, and the statutes 990.06 and 991.07 sets forth a methodology for determining which statute of limitations applies when there's been an amendment to the statute of limitations. When that happens, a cause of action that has accrued prior to the effective date of the new statute is governed by the prior statute. In other words, the statute in place in 1966 to 72, unless the legislature specifies otherwise. In this case, none of the legislative changes over the years has extinguished or indicated that the legislature has specified otherwise with respect to the original statute at the time of the charged crimes, that that's controlling. The first change that actually occurred in the statute of limitations occurred when the legislature created Chapter 948. And when it created Chapter 948, this is it by 1987 WIS Act 332. When it created Chapter 948, it also created Subdivision 2C of the statute of limitations. Subsection 2C. Is the one that talks about bringing a crime within a specific, it's referenced to the victim age. In other words, the crime could be brought within the 6-year period or before the victim reaches a particular age. And critical to this analysis is the legislature has never, the original statute that did this, which was what created Chapter 948, expressly said that this applies only to offenses that occur on or after July 1st, 1989. All the crimes referenced in that 2C provision are Chapter 948 crimes. Thereafter, when the legislature amended it, it did so by expanding the statute of limitations with respect to that victim age-based provision from 21 years to 26 to 31 to 45, and now in some cases can be brought at any time. The state believes that all these changes only apply to crimes that occurred on or after July 1st, 1989 that are brought under Chapter 948 with one of those specific provisions. If this court disagrees with that analysis, which I think is a straightforward, clear analysis, the statute that was in place at the time of the charged crimes is the governing statute. If this court disagrees, even under looking at 2C, you don't get to the age of the victim statute, or that age as a potential lengthening of the limitations period, unless Subdivision 1, the 6-year period, has expired. That's what the language says for all of these amendments of the statute. Notwithstanding that the time limitation under Sub 1 has expired. So if the time limitation under Sub 1, the 6-year period, hasn't expired, due to public tolling, you never worry about the age-based limitations period. That's the alternative. Again, I, It's an alternative argument. The primary argument is simply this debt, all these 2C provisions don't apply to the Chapter 944 crimes that occurred back in 1966 to 72.
What about this argument? You were talking about 1987. As I recall, the legislation in 1987 had specific provisions, I might be wrong on this, that indicated that it transferred to or revised the older statutes into the new legislation, transferred to, revised. That the problem with the chain that the and so that would be in accord with the chain theory. The constructively survives theory that your opposing counsel advances. But the break in the chain came in 1975 when the legislation was that it was just, the prior stuff was just repealed. It wasn't transferred or just renumbered or revised. Can you address that argument? You're not making that, and maybe that argument is just in my head.
Well, you're talking about the repeal of the substantive crimes, the Chapter 944 provisions.
That's
what
right.
occurred mm-hmm. in 1975.
That's exactly it.
Right. Those crimes, child sexual assault, were recodified, modified, and put into Chapter 940.225 at that time. That becomes important with respect to limitations only if the crime of child sexual, the underlying charges, child sexual assault, somehow the legislature said, we're not going to criminalize that anymore. That's not a crime. If that were the case, then the statute of limitations problem, I mean, there wouldn't be, the state couldn't bring those crimes if that was no longer the case. If the state hadn't charged the Chapter 944 crimes before they were no longer crimes, mm-hmm. you can't go back and do it now. That's where that comes into play. And actually 990.04 talks about what happens when you repeal a substantive criminal statute. And none of the language, as I understand it, in 1975, and certainly it's clear from the language of the subsequent provisions, 940.225, 948.2, the legislature never intended to do away with the crime of child sexual assault.
So regardless of what it said on its face, that is, 75 just said repealed, and all the subsequent ones used such terms, and it becomes important because, of course, we have case law that says it has to be explicitly and expressly stated. And so when they say repealed and renumbered, repealed and recreated, transferred to or revised to, and 75 doesn't have that language, you're saying that's of no moment in your argument.
As far as I, yes. Turning, I guess, then to due process, unless there are any other questions about the statute of limitations.
Well, my question is this, and maybe it's not sufficiently detailed and you can't answer it, but what we say and what the state proposes in this case is not only for the defendant here, but affects all defendants, and not even in limited to sexual assault cases necessarily, but all cases, right?
Correct.
And so the state's position here that the statute of limitations at the date of charging applies unless the legislature specifies otherwise. State understands that and continues with that, recognizing it could apply to a multitude of cases?
Yes.
Okay.
Counselor, is it the date of charging or the date of the crime?
The governing statute of limitations is the date of the crime.
Right, and she said the date of the charging, I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's why I want to be sure we're on the same
page. I didn't hear that. I apologize.
Right.
No, it's the date of the charged crime that governs.
So you left the word charge out. It's the date at which the state is alleging the crime occurred. It's that statute that the state
maintains. But it's the charged crime, maybe not another crime involved. The charged crime. Okay, right. Got it.
You know, the follow-up of the chief's question is something that has been bothering me. That is, kind of, what are the ramifications of your argument to other cases in this kind of area? Because it is in this area of sexual assault, child sexual assault, that we see a number of these cases that are brought beyond the traditional statute of limitations. But what are the ramifications of your argument for the next case? The next case that doesn't want to be limited by a 6-year of statute of limitations, but doesn't have the fact situation where the defendant was out of state or allegedly out of state for the period of time.
I mean, so you're talking about crimes that preceded the 948. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to? Mm-hmm. Old crimes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That the state, I believe, under that scenario, for example, even in this case, if these complainants were under the age of 45, that would not save this prosecution. The state. All those crimes that occurred before Chapter 948 under the old statute of limitations, the one without the age-based alternative, uh-huh. had to be brought within 6 years unless there was a public tolling provision that extended that time.
So it's the state's position that the date that of the crime charged governs and that it's not going to be extended by any of these statutes. So if the 6 years has passed, the person's been in the state for the entire 6 years, that the victim is now 28, I'm not sure my time periods work with the statutes, but gone. They can't prosecute.
State's analysis, correct.
Mm-hmm. And when is that age base came in? Was that in 80s?
That was when Chapter 948 was created, effective for crimes July 1st, 1989. That's a critical date.
Yeah, that's right. Past 87, effective 89. So any crimes prior to 1989.
It's actually prior to July 1st, 1989. That's a specific cutoff date.
So would the next case that where you had a... Let me ask. The next case where there is a alleged sexual assault in December of 1988, there would be no prosecution possibility for it. Is that
and the person
right?
stayed in state.
And the person stayed
for,
in state, yes.
For 1988 child sexual assault, the governing statute of limitations is the one that was existing back in 1966, same one, 939.74. 6-year limitations period, public resident tolling would be the only thing that would save that statute. I'm not sure, I should qualify that just one thing. I'm not sure if the therapist, there's one other tolling provision in the statutes that deals with therapists.
But assuming no tolling.
Right, correct. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And the reason why that is that once that statute of limitations expires or lapses, that's when the defendant acquires a vested interest in that defense.
This is the substantive provision.
That's correct.
Statute of limitations.
That's correct. Turning then to due process.
We have cases that say that. It's a substantive due process. Once it's expired, the legislature can't revive it.
That's correct. You've got ex post facto problems if you attempt to do that.
Unless there's a revival before the expiration.
In fact, that's what happened with all these amendments expanding it after that. In fact, they were designed by the age of the victim so that any child sexual assault that occurred after July 1st, 1989 will now be covered.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least, up to age 45, and the more serious ones are now, you can bring them at, there's no limitations period on them.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to due process, The state's position is that Mr. MacArthur has not shown either actual prejudice from the pre-charging delay or that the delay is attributable to the state. One thing I would note from the non-party brief is the concern with the proper test. This court in Wilson said it's a conjunctive two-part test, actual prejudice and prosecutorial misconduct. The U.S. Supreme Court cases leave open the door, I think, to the possibility of recklessness or a severe, something short of actual prosecutorial misconduct may be enough to establish a due process violation. In this case, that standard doesn't really matter, but I just for the court's consideration.
Mr. Brown, I had a question about the standard to be applied. From what I heard from Mr. Flynn, it appears as though he's not really pushing this argument, but I'm more concerned about the standard. My understanding is that the defendant has to establish actual prejudice, but that the burden is on the prosecution to offer good faith justification for the delay. The burden is not on the defendant.
My understanding was that the burden did not shift. In the Wilson case, I understood it to be the defendant's burden both on showing actual prejudice and prosecutorial misconduct. I can understand why, just as with respect to public residency, maybe the state's in a better position to know at some level that it was being unfair, but I understand the burden to still be on the defendant under Wilson with respect to
that. I guess my question goes to the Lobasco case from the United States Supreme Court.
If that case says differently, then I stand corrected, but I don't know that it did.
All right.
I don't think so anyway.
Now, counsel, it's you're not going to discuss deposition because a defendant has said he's withdrawn that issue.
Sure, and I think it's pretty clear from this court's decision in Williamson that the propriety of a defendant's statement or the constitutionality of it doesn't affect its consideration when it comes to probable cause in a complaint or at a preliminary hearing. But this court doesn't even need to address that because in this case the complaint contained the statements of the complainants, which would be enough to pass probable cause.
Now, the defendant asks the court to dismiss this prosecution either for constitutional grounds or for the statute of limitations. My understanding is that you would say this court should not dismiss on statute of limitations a ground, but that, if I understood your brief, that you want the court to remand this case. Is that right?
The trial court never decided whether there was tolling by the public residence,
okay.
So it has to go back to the trial court.
The court to reverse that part of the trial court's order which requires the state to prove compliance, okay. But the court should remand to the trial court with the following directions. We've got six briefs, so I always wonder whose brief I'm reading. Before trial, the court should determine the application of the public resident tolling provision holding the state to proof by a preponderance of evidence. Okay? And then you have another provision on page 31, and we're both looking at the same brief, I think, that says if there's an issue about the charging dates, a factual issue about the date or range of dates for the charge one, that would go to we should instruct the trial court. It should go to the jury maybe by a special verdict question, which is unusual in criminal cases, to determine the reasonable range of dates by the preponderance.
In other words, the only time there's going to be an issue, if I may finish, I see my time's up. The only time there's going to be a jury issue is if during the course of trial the evidence that comes in about a specific charged crime, about a specific crime, is such that it might have actually occurred outside the limitations period. In that situation, you better have a special question to decide the date.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Flynn.
The discussion about the repeal of 975 of Chapter 944 and folding that conduct into Chapter 940.225 and again 940.225 into 948.02. If what we have included in my brief is the discussion at both those moments in the notes attached to the statute, and when 940.225 became 948.02, the legislature said these provisions are transferred to and revised in new Chapter 948 created in this bill. At page 118 of my appendix, they did almost the identical thing with 944 into 940.225 by saying the old cross-reference shall be 944, 10, and 11. And in fact, in the text of it, at section 13, and I'm looking at the middle of page 118 of my appendix on my first brief, it specifically states in the sections of the statutes listed in column A, cross-references in column B. So I would submit the legislature effectively did the same thing at both times, and it's really just the format and the way the words were arranged that is any different. So there is of no moment. I would suggest as well, if we look at the plain reading of the statute in 1993, 949.74 sub 2C, it reads, a prosecution for a violation of 948 shall be commenced before the victim reaches the age of 26 years or be barred. It's very, very clear mandate from the legislature. And
Counselor, weren't the charging documents referencing 944, not 948?
Where is it?
No. Weren't the charging documents referencing 944,
yes,
not 948?
That's correct. It's charged violation of the conduct prescribed by Chapter 944. That's correct. But this statute specifically states it applies to actions not yet barred. Not yet barred. And I submit when the legislature passed this statute, it didn't intend if there was a 5 or 6 year old that had been assaulted in 1988 or early 1989, by 1995 when she was 11, there would be no cause of action. There'd be no prosecution for that. I think the legislature intended, and you can look at by the rapidly escalating ages, 21, 26, 45, there's a catch-up here. They want to go back. They're not contemplating the future and say further, looking back, because they want to prosecute that conduct. And I think the state has lost sight of that legislative intent in its arguments in pursuing Defendant MacArthur.
Counsel, if your client had not left the state, would you still be arguing that the new statutes apply?
No, I would argue that under State versus Haynes, he had a vested right in 1978 when that 6 year statute expired, and that the subsequent passage in 87 and 93 wouldn't apply.
Why wouldn't his vested right be in the provisions from Chapter 939 from the 1966 through 72 statutes?
It is. That was the statute of limitation under which he was subject to until 1987.
Okay.
And
so
then in 1993 and then 19 and subsequently.
So if he still lived in the state and they charged him when they found out, presumably in 2006 or whenever they found out, you would now be arguing that that prosecution is barred because the statute of limitations is 6 years.
Yeah, and had they charged him in 2006 and he'd been living in the state the whole time, yes. I would have said under State versus Haynes, that statute of limitations expired.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, and I think, and, you know, to make sense of it, I think we're traditionally accustomed to a six-year statute of limitations, and in 87, I think what the confusion comes in that hybrid period where it may, whichever is later, but then I insist the legislature explicitly rejected that and said shall be barred, shall be commenced or be barred. And what I'm suggesting is a clear, uniform statute of limitations. Look at the age of the alleged victim, and that's where we go. And now it's life. And now it's 45. And that includes perpetrators from in the 70s and the 80s. And the state would have those excluded from prosecution, according to its argument. And I think it might be that an 87-year-old man can't be prosecuted under my analysis, but I think it's clearly what the legislature intended to do. The other thing I want to discuss is, and I have seen my red light is on, Yes, my 5 minutes
is.
Are gone already.
Right.
Okay, thank
moves
you very
quickly. Thank you,
thank
Mr.
You very
Flynn.
Much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn, and thank you for Mr. Frymuth for your excellent arguments this morning on this issue of statute of limitations and the other related issues. That concludes our hearing in 2006 AP 1379 CR, State versus MacArthur. The court will take a brief recess to let other students in and let these students leave if they're scheduled to do so.